Welcome to the Therapist Connect podcast. Dr. Peter Blundell interviews therapists about their work and experiences within the therapist community.
Hello, and welcome to Therapist Connect, the podcast. My name is Dr. Peter Blundell, and today I'm delighted to be interviewing Sam Driscoll. I first met Sam on Twitter. His Twitter handle is @CounsellorDrisk. Sam is a therapist, person-centered therapist who works in private practice around the East Sussex and Eastbourne area. And his website is www.samdriscolltherapy.com.
Hello.
Hello. How are you doing?
Yeah, not bad. How are you?
Good. Yeah, I'm really well, thank you.
Yeah, it's a pleasure to meet you.
You too. Are you having a good day?
Yeah, not a bad day. Fairly busy. So after this signifies the end of my working week. So I'm looking forward to the weekend.
You can relax. Yeah.
Unwind.
Yeah, fantastic. It's really nice to kind of, not necessarily meet you face-to-face, but speak to you face-to-face at least. Because we've communicated a bit on Twitter. It's nice to kind of actually put a voice to the to the tweets.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, it's... Yeah, it feels a little bit surreal, Peter. I'm not going to lie. You're the first person I've ever spoken to or that I've interacted with on Twitter. So
fantastic. I find that quite surprising because you've got quite a lot of followers on Twitter, haven't you? You've got like 5,000 followers, I think, or something.
Yeah, I do. But I mean, the truth is a lot of those followers I gained when I, what feels like almost in another life. So that was years ago when I was... it's trying to help someone in the music industry. So I put a lot of work and effort into social media, a lot more than I do now. I do have a lot of followers, but it's from...
they're not necessarily therapists then.
No,
exactly. Those followers.
Exactly.
Okay. Which is fine. So my first question then is going to be about how did you end up becoming a therapist? Kind of what drew you to wanting to be a therapist?
I suppose what drew me to being a therapist was, I mean, first of all, it was one of those things when I was a younger lad, when I was sort of in my early 20s, it was something that had been suggested to me a couple of times, like, you'd be a great therapist, or have you thought of being a therapist? And at the time, it was like, well, I mean, it didn't really fit with my self-structure. You know, I wanted to be a lad. I didn't really want to sit in a room talking about feelings or mental health. I wanted to essentially make lots of money. And then, you know, long, complex story, very short. Essentially, I ended up having a breakdown, which led to me being hospitalized for a little while. And I did receive some mental health support, which I experienced to be fairly inadequate.
Mm-hmm.
And the gift through that process was sort of like my self-structure didn't completely collapse, but there was a lot more movement. I was able to reflect more on who I wanted to become, what I valued, rather than what I thought I should value or the goals that I thought I should obtain. And that was what sort of led me to think, oh, actually, you know, I am drawn, if someone's suffering, I am drawn to trying to support them. I am, you know, it felt like it naturally aligned with me. So I essentially went and booked myself on a day taster training course before, well, I'll dip my toe in the water and, yeah, just never looked back. Just after then, went straight on to a level one, a level two, then went on to do a foundation degree with a top-up bachelor's degree, and, yeah, it's been life-changing, really. So to answer your question, I feel essentially that it aligns with my natural way of being. This is naturally who I am, you know. I was an amateur therapist before I was a professional therapist, if that makes sense to you.
I think it's interesting, that idea, isn't it, of that, you know, is it inherently there in people anyway, and kind of we just go through the training, which kind of just gives us the bigger insights into what it's about, really, but like the way of being is kind of with us from as early as you can remember.
Yeah, exactly. And I think, you know, I tend to agree with that statement. I think that something about me is I'm a very sensitive person. Something I've always tried to push myself away from. I never wanted to be sensitive. I used to perceive it as sort of like a weakness in my younger days. I didn't want to care so much about things and stuff like that. So I feel training, a lot of it is about training and learning ethics, boundaries, you know, what's appropriate, what's inappropriate. But a lot of it is, it's a bit like art, you know, some people are born and they can just paint beautiful paintings, and other people can train and learn, but some people, they're more naturally inclined to it, I suppose.
Yeah, absolutely. So you found therapy, you found a career in therapy. When did you qualify?
So I started my training in 2013. Mm-hmm. I would have qualified by 2016, but then I carried on doing a top-up year to give myself a bachelor's degree in 2017.
Okay. And can you tell me what has been your practice from 2017 to now then? Have you been private practice, or have you worked in agencies? Or
yeah, I have worked for an agency before. I did work for a Survivors of Suicide service, which was my first sort of professional role where I was actually getting paid. Unfortunately, that didn't really work out for me for sort of political reasons, which perhaps we can discuss, I don't know, mm-hmm. in a bit or so. But yeah, since then, I've been in private practice. I mean, I come very, very close to not making the cut. After my stint working for Survivors of Suicide service, I couldn't find employment anywhere. I ended up becoming a delivery driver again for a couple of months. And my whole ambition of becoming a therapist just sort of fell apart until I sort of like had a day where I was like, no, all this work, all this effort, this is not what I want. So I made a blind leap of faith, essentially, and just set up my private practice. And I think I've been fairly fortunate with my private practice. And it's sustained me. And then since then as well, for about a year and a half, I work as a specialist mental health mentor for mm-hmm. a university, which, you know, and that's another quite interesting thing. What's the difference between therapy and mentoring? It's quite... some people seem to think there's like a clear distinction. I've been doing it for over 18 months now, and I can't quite make the distinction. I suppose you could swap the word mentoring with solution-focused therapy, but it's still very therapy sort of based. So that's been me, really. I've set up a private practice in 2017, and it's still going. Yeah,
fantastic. And I'm glad that you've eventually been able to find that kind of success with that, really, and that kind of role. How challenging was it then when you kind of felt like that might not happen, actually, and that you were kind of not going to have a career as a therapist? I imagine that was quite difficult.
Yeah, I mean, it was quite a stressful time because essentially I'd done all this studying. I'd got into my student debt to become qualified, and I left the Survivors of Suicide service. I ended up on Job Seekers Allowance. And I just wasn't being very successful. I was applying for every single counselling related job I saw, or key worker role job I saw. I rarely got an interview. And if I got an interview, I never got through. And it got to the point where I don't know what they call them, like job search coach or something, the person I saw at the job centre every week, was essentially saying, right, there's a job here at KFC, there's a job here, and there's a job there. And I said, no, I really don't want to do that. And I essentially got told, well, you know, then you're not doing everything you can to secure a job. And it was all this pressure was mounting up. So I went for one of the jobs, which was a delivery driver for Argos, and I got it. And I thought, wow, this is okay, you know, I'm earning. But it really wasn't really fulfilling for me. And the other thing is I have a back condition, I have a bad back, so doing delivery work and humping. Yeah. I was feeling hurt, and it was just out of desperation and a real bit of luck. So I went to my old college where I'd done my training for a student board sort of meeting as a ex-student. And I happened to meet another student in the year below me, and she said she'd just set up a counselling room, and she was struggling. She was looking for therapists to hire the room on an ad hoc basis. And I just thought, you know what, I'll just give it a go, you know. Yeah, I spent a lot of time setting up my website, counselling directory profile, Psychology Today. Well, no, not Psychology Today, that came later. I'd say within about 3 months of initially setting up, I had 10 clients. So all of a sudden, I wasn't so dependent on the delivery driving job. I thought, oh, I'm gonna put that away. And I've not looked back since. So, it was a bit of desperation, a lot of stress, and a bit of luck. And that, you know, I mean, I hate to think, if I hadn't met Mia, the other therapist who I got the room, I'd probably be a delivery driver now. I mean, who knows?
Yeah. It's just that bit of luck that you ended up connecting and kind of, and then that change happened. And I suppose as well, kind of moving from straight into private practice, it can be quite scary for people really as a therapist, because there's that additional, those additional things that you need to do outside of it if you work in an agency, isn't there, that you have to set up and put in place?
Oh yeah, definitely. I'd say it's starkly different. And I mean, saying that, I'd say to therapists just starting out, it's good to start in private practice, it's good, but you need to make sure you've got some adequate support in place, because for me, the difference between working for an agency and in private practice, an agency has all these policies and procedures that you must follow if certain things arise, which takes some of the responsibility off my shoulders. You know, it's very different working with somebody who's suicidal in an agency with policies and procedures that you follow. You're kind of covered by following them. In private practice, I mean, I'm responsible for the decisions I make. You know, do I call the GP? Do I not call the GP? Do I, you know, it gets a lot more, it can become a much more heavy burden, I suppose, in private practice.
And as you say, it's your responsibility, so you're making that ultimate final decision, and the policies are your own policies and procedures in terms of making that judgment, really. So there is definitely a bigger responsibility. Have you found any benefits to private or practice, or rewards to private practice as well then?
Yeah, I mean, I really love my private practice. I love, you know, because, you know... the other side of the coin, for example, is I make my own policies and procedures. So, for example, back when I was training, I had a placement, and one of their policies was, is if suicidal ideation is mentioned in the slightest, you have to ring the DP with the client. And that was expected. And that, in my mind, well, one, it's incredibly uncomfortable.
Yeah.
And it's sort of silencing for the client, I felt. And two, I didn't particularly think that was helpful. I didn't think that was working in the client's best interest. I felt that was being overly cautious at the agency.
So
even though I haven't got the responsibility, being forced to respond in a way that I wouldn't naturally respond. So, although the responsibility is greater, the freedom is greater, and I really appreciate that, because... I suppose it enables me to feel like although I'm taking the responsibility for the work I do, I feel I'm doing the best I can and following my own judgment, which I trust.
And that idea as well of being able to sit with an element of risk as well, you know, and being able to sit and say, okay, you know, I don't believe this is going to go to the next steps, or else I would do something about it. Whereas it sounds like that agency was found that quite difficult to do.
Yeah, very difficult. I mean, personally, in a private practice, if we're talking suicide, that's fine. We're confidential, it's safe. Suicidal thoughts, even suicidal intent and planning is okay, although harder to hold. But it's the only time, like, right, I'm contacting someone now, is if they say, yeah, I'm leaving, I'm going to take my life. I've got a plan, I've got a date, this is what I'm doing. Then, at that moment, I think, okay. But up until that point, it's... I find it's better, personally, and more empowering to try and help the person who's suffering to reach out for further support. They spoke to their GP about how they're feeling. Do their loved ones, you know, try and empower their own autonomy to take care of themselves, I suppose. So,
and explore it to see, you know, what is that about, and is it a concrete plan, or is it something else going on for somebody? So, yeah. How would you describe your therapeutic approach then? See on Twitter you say person-centered. Is that still central to what you do?
Yes, so I would always argue I'm person-centered. I've got a bachelor's degree in person-centered counselling. I studied it for a little bit over 4 years. Mm-hmm. But, I mean, I'm not sure if you've experienced this, Peter. You can have four people in a room, they all say they're person-centered and all practice very differently, have very different values and different ideas of what it means to be person-centered. So I think for me, I'm person-centered. I identify as person-centered and I advertise myself as person-centered. I'm fairly sure, though, if other therapists could be a fly in the wall in my counselling room, they'd say, no, you're not person-centered. That's integrative or that's pluralistic or you're bringing in other things. But for me, my understanding of person-centered therapy is it encapsulates all that. There's no, this is person-centered, this is not person-centered, because it's kind of impossible. I feel it's impossible to define person-centered therapy without the practitioner and without the client. Without those two variables, we have some loose theory, but it's impossible to really define. I identify as person-centered, although...
Whatever that means. Disagree.
Yeah, exactly. whatever the hell that means, I don't know anymore.
It's interesting that, and I'm wondering as well, as we grow and develop as therapists, how our identity changes, do you know what I mean, in that respect? And, you know, like when I qualified, like I had very, very clear views about what that was. Mm. And then kind of as I've gone on, I'm kind of like, well, they're kind of clear, but maybe they've changed a little bit since then, you know.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, I say this to my peers sometimes, and sometimes I've reached a point I don't even think I know what I'm doing anymore. The everything's become so blurred, nothing's so defined, you know. I respond in some ways to some people, but it's very different to how I respond to other people with the same sort of stuff going on. And I think it's that. I think both are right. Saying I found some dealing with the uncertainty of not knowing and really getting a sense of that. So I, you know, doing the best I can, but just not knowing if it's not knowing why I'm responding the way I'm responding to a certain thing and having that internal uncertainty. So,
and that's part of counselling journey, whether you're a therapist or a client, isn't it? Is leading towards sitting with uncertainty and actually not knowing.
yeah exactly. And it's I must admit, Peter, if I'd gone for my first day training, the tutor turned around to me and said, so with this profession can come a great deal of anxiety that you might have to manage on and off. If I'd been aware of quite the level of that, mm-hmm. whether I would have marched forward so directly and almost blindly, I'm not so sure, because it's I love being a therapist, but it does come at a cost to me. I'm always reflecting, like, oh God, you know, did I pick up on that? Have I responded to that approach? Do you know what I mean? Even when it comes to, I thought once I was a qualified therapist, it'd be great. I'd meet people, I'd know what I was doing, everything would be perfect. But the first client anxiety, I thought that would sort of reduce over time. It just, you know, that feeling I have sat there where I've got someone coming, I you know, it's a bit of a challenge for me, I suppose.
And I suppose every client is unique, aren't they? So no matter where you start, you don't know where it's going to end up. And so there is that uncertainty, potentially anxiety, thinking, well, what does happen now? Or these things that I've said previously, which really help someone, this person isn't even acknowledging that it's all helpful.
And that's all that panic sensation of that I've had before, where I feel like I'm not meeting a therapeutic need within a client, and not being able to really discover what it is the client's sort of looking for. And those uncomfortable conversations I've had where, you know, I find myself wondering whether a client's finding use of therapy, because it doesn't feel very cohesive. It doesn't feel like a therapeutic dance. It's just feeling a bit fractured and a bit difficult. And they respond, oh, yeah, no, this is really great. And I sit there thinking, I don't know what's going on.
That's what supervision's for.
Oh, yeah, exactly. Supervision's definitely a necessity.
Yeah. Have you got any advice if anybody was coming into the profession now? What would you do, or thinking about coming into the profession? Have you got any advice for what you would say to them? Or,
well, I mean, as you know, person-centered advice is a strong buzzword. Oh, don't do that. But no, one thing, self-care, the significance of self-care. I never really got it as a trainee. It all felt a bit self-indulgent to me, the way self-care was taught to me about, you know, taking time out and having a nice long relaxing bath and a nice walk and read a nice book. It all just felt, I don't know, I didn't quite buy into it. But I think actually if you want to become a therapist, you really need to be able to take care of yourself. And by that, I mean, yeah, but take care, rest when you need to rest, but work hard when you need to work hard. And it's, for me, self-care is like balance. You've got to maintain balance, because if you're off balance, I suppose through personal experience, if I'm not taking care of myself, my mental health begins to really suffer. If my mental health is beginning to really suffer, the therapy that people are getting through working with me is not necessarily adequate. You want to be a therapist, be prepared to take care of yourself, whatever that means on an individual level. And another thing, and this sort of ties in with my experience with the Survivors of Suicide Service, is acknowledge your worth. The reason I ended up leaving the Survivors of Suicide Service was I was offered a job on the undertaking. I'd still volunteer for them on another service, on a low-cost service they're working at, and it equated to the agency valued my time at £4 an hour. And I won't go into any details of any individual work, but I had times, you know, here, vicarious trauma, where some of the stuff that was being explored in the therapy room was really impacting me, and I'm that sense of being valued at £4 an hour. I mean, don't get me wrong, offering therapy and being a therapist is more than making a living and earning money. I acknowledge that, but I feel that on a collective level, that perhaps counsellors' natural kind nature is potentially taken advantage of. So yeah, I think it's important we value ourselves and what we do, and don't overextend ourselves due to the expectation of an agency that's saying, you know, there's a service that's needed. Because I can remember being sat in that counseling room that time after a particularly tough session. I walked out the counseling session, there's an office of about 8 different people. Now, for all these people are getting paid more money than me, and they're all sat here, they're laughing, they're having a good time, and I've just heard some stuff that's really affected me, you know. And I brought it up with my coordinator at the time, saying, you know, I was a bit uncomfortable with the pay situation. Technically, I was earning less than minimum wage, and I essentially got told, you know, like it or lump it. I had done the ethical thing. I saw my work to the end, but that was it for me.
And that was, you know, must have been a tough decision to kind of walk away from that and take that stance, you know, to turn away paid work.
Yeah. Like I say, it wasn't an easy decision to make. But I think, you know, I just think with the situation I was in and the money I was earning, you know, and when I started my training, I was all about, you know, volunteering is a good thing, we should do it. But I think in our industry, it's become so normalized now that you're almost a bad person if you don't want to volunteer. And I'm not really sure of many other industries where there's that expectation. You know, we train. Most training requires you to volunteer at least 100 hours, which often goes into more hours. I think, okay, so we do our bit to learn, and we invest in our own private therapy, our own supervision, we pay for our training, we get to a point we're qualified. And then, you know, and I think for some people who can volunteer, that's great. I don't want to knock them for what they're doing, but for it to be expected for, you know, for training bodies to advertise level 4 training so you could be a volunteer counsellor, it rubs me up the wrong way a little bit. It's a bit of a political issue for me.
So
that's why I think if you're training, just acknowledge your own worth. You know, you're bringing skills to the table and sitting there working with stuff that is worthy of respect, acknowledgement of your time, and a sense of being valued, even if that's they're paying for your CPD and your supervision or paying your expenses or whatever. But when it's being sold as, oh, look at this great opportunity we're offering you, that's when I'm a bit,
And actually going through that training, and for people who've not done it, maybe don't always understand the level of training that people go through to become a qualified counsellor or therapist is extensive. And, you know, the amount of self-development that you have to go through, and as you say, the money that people invest in terms of that training, when people come out the other side, they are, you know, qualified to work with people really complex nature quite often. And I think you're right, being able to value yourself and saying, actually, I'm worth this, I don't think there's any shame in that.
No, I don't. But I'm also aware it's like a political hot potato, you know, people talk about on social media, there's strong arguments either side, you know. But yeah, I just think for me, myself, when I was training, I was just so grateful for any opportunity. It's so hard to secure a placement in the first place and going the extra mile. And then, yeah, I just got so far and I just thought, no, hang on, I don't feel like I'm being valued now. And I think if I'd carried on with them, that bitter taste that it was leaving in my mouth would have perhaps turned me away from counselling if that had gone on too long.
Yeah,
I'm glad I got out when I did, yeah.
Well, thankfully, we've managed to keep you within the profession.
Just about, holding on by my fingertips.
Have you got any areas that you either specialise in or that you're just particularly interested in, or are you kind of very open, I suppose, being in private practice, you might be quite more?
Oh, yeah, I suppose in private practice, when you set up in private practice, a lot of people advise it's important you find a niche. And I agree with that, you know, people, we live in a problem solution society, you know, if there's a problem, we find a professional who can give us a solution, and that's, so from a business perspective, that's good, but from a person-centered perspective, that whole philosophy, if I focus on a problem, well, I'm kind of missing the person and the complexity that surrounds that. I mean, I do take specific CPD in certain areas. I think it's important to develop knowledge in specialized areas, but I don't really specialise in anything. I'm open to working with essentially anyone and anything with some limitations. So if someone had a severe eating disorder, I wouldn't feel that I'm adequately trained to work in that area. But other than that, I don't know. I take things as a case-by-case thing. But other than that, I don't think there's anything that may go, oh, no, I can't work with you. But I would say person-centered specialism is probably best described as empowerment. Mm. You know, that's how I see it. I see person-centered philosophy about trying to participate in relationships that people find empowering in some way, where people feel more able to make decisions and guide their life in a way that resonates closer with their own genuine values rather than perhaps superficial values that have been imposed upon them.
That's
where I'm at the moment with it. I mean, 10 years time, who knows, I could be a specialist in whatever. I don't know, you know, every day, take one day at a time.
Fantastic. How connected do you feel to like the wider therapist community, like either in your area or just the community in general? Do you feel connected to it, or since you've been qualified?
I'm fairly connected. I'm perhaps not as connected as I'd like to be in an ideal world, but you know, there's a person-centered community group that's set up once a month. I used to go to that every single month. Religiously, I haven't been going to that so much recently, but you know, there's a lot of person-centered therapists working in the same town that I know who they are, they know who I am. I have a really good working alliance with my friend Mia, who I mentioned earlier. She was the one who sort of like I ended up renting a room off her. We since, over the past couple of years, set up investing in getting more counselling rooms, covering the rent and renting them out on an ad hoc basis to therapists as and when they need. So me and Mia and another therapist, Stephanie, we have bi-weekly, if not weekly, meetings about professional development. I'm connected with, not as connected as I'd like to be, but some people that I trained with, you know, WhatsApp groups.
So that sounds like quite a few connections there, actually.
Yeah, I mean, I do. I mean, my most valued connection is probably with Mia, because we see each other a lot. We discuss things a lot. We offer each other peer supervision as and when needed. But yeah, I mean, a lot of the other connections, they're sort of loose connections, you know. I think when I train, I mean, one thing that I really liked about person-centered theory and Carl Rogers in particular was this idea he was a quiet revolutionary, you know. Yeah. He was somebody who was actually... he was changing the rules of the game, and no one really knew what he was doing, and he really come out on top of it all. And I thought, oh, okay, so, you know, I'm going to find my tribe, and we're going to carry on. We're going to pick up and sort of carry on with this quiet revolution. I haven't quite found anyone else who's on the same page as me with that, you know? So, I'm loosely connected. I'd like to be more connected. But then the other thing is acknowledging my own limitations. I don't believe in fixed noun descriptors of our way of being, but I am fairly introverted. You know, that's a spectrum and I go up and down it, but I'm fairly introverted. So with the work I do and being a father to three young children and having a wife, I'm very depleted. You know, a lot of the time when I haven't got professional responsibilities or family responsibilities, I'm like, I just really want to be left on my own and sort of process my week and what's going on for me to let the dust settle. So it's,
I think that's a really important point, as well as feel it important to feel connected to the community. Actually, sometimes we need to be able to step away from it and kind of say, actually, I need my own space and my own time, which goes back to that self-care that you were talking about at the beginning.
Exactly that. So, I think in the future, perhaps when my fatherly responsibilities have diminished a bit and things are a bit quiet, I'd like to be more involved. You know, I see what, you know, Counsellors Together UK, Maria, Glenna and Tara and the work there. I'd love to be more involved in that sort of, you know, I'm part of the profession. I want to do something that's good for the profession and the professionals working within it. And I really admire what they're doing. And I sort of watch them from a distance and they have my utmost respect. And I'd like to be more involved, but my limitations are just for me to carry on work, doing this work, I need to take care of myself and I can't stretch myself.
Absolutely. And I think that's the balance though, isn't it? But I suppose supporting those campaigns when we believe in them and is important. But, you know, just doing what you can really is good enough, isn't it? We don't have to push ourselves to go beyond what we're able to do because of our circumstances or whatever. Yeah.
Exactly that.
Yeah. Well, I think that's all my questions really. Yeah. How did you find doing that? Was it okay?
Yeah, no, that was great, Peter. Great, man. All right, Peter. Well, I appreciate that. Thank you. And thank you for taking the time to do this.
No worries. It's been really good. And I'm sure we'll chat again soon and we'll speak on Twitter.
Yeah, no doubt.
All right, cheers, Sam. All right, take care of yourself. Bye now.
Thank you for listening to the Therapist Connect podcast. Go to www.therapist-connect.com for more discussions and debates.